Welcome to a special, they're all special, but this one is especially special, Monday morning edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. I'm joined by Danny LaRue today after a 114-111 Cleveland victory over the Hawks in overtime. LeBron James basically single-handedly took his team to victory. Not the most efficient performance from him, but really when you consider the help that he has on a team that really has nobody else who can create for anyone else. It's really, you know, when Matthew Dellavedova is your other ball handler and your other distributor, I think it's pretty impressive to have a team up 3-0 in a series, one game away from the NBA Finals.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is a Cleveland team that has a lot of players that are designed to take advantage of the opportunities created by others with Kyrie and Kevin Love out. Those are the two guys who are more independent, like LeBron James. So you have guys like Shumpert and J.R. Smith, and so that means LeBron is the straw that stirs the drink, and he's done a pretty remarkable job. I mean, as you said, it's not necessarily the most efficient thing every game, but he's being asked to do a lot on a team that can really key on him, and it's been really impressive the whole playoffs. But this kind of LeBron, while it's not my favorite to watch, they're winning games, and that's all you can ask him to do.
Yeah, and we've been critical of Cleveland's style, and you would like to see them run a few more pick and rolls, get a little more ball movement at times. But now that, especially now that Kyrie is out, and certainly with Love out, I don't think they have that much more of an option than putting the ball in LeBron's hands. And what did he have in this game? Some crazy number of touches, you said?
Oh, yeah. It was, he had 140 in this game. And that, I asked our friend Seth Partnow if he happened to know if there was anybody with more, and he didn't. But off the top of my head, I can't remember it. Granted, this was an overtime game, but that's astonishing. 140. I mean,
yeah, usually you'll see the point guard in a contested game where he plays a lot of minutes might get 100 touches. For reference of how much that is. Now, granted, this went into overtime, and in the clutch, he's going to be touching it every time, too. But then you also, I mean, I don't think we had the time of possession available, but you consider the time of possession as well, it had to just be crazy how much he had the ball. And, you know, we've been critical of LeBron, I think, a little bit for his style, and especially me. I don't want to speak for you, but, you know, let's keep this on a backdrop of the fact that he really is, in my mind at least, obviously the second best player of all time when you look at post-merger, which is really the important time to look at, because I think the NBA before that was just a different game. You had eight teams, and then you went from 8 to 17 teams in a matter of about 5-6 years, and you had the ABA. So really, until those leagues merged for the 76-77 season, you're kind of playing a different game. You didn't have the three-point line. So since then, I mean, it's very clear to me that LeBron is the second best. I mean, you look, some of the other people you might compare him to would be, you know, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird. I think, you know, LeBron, a much better defensive player than either of those guys. He's going to have a lot more longevity than either of those guys. And, you know, probably a better scorer than any of those guys either, but still close to the level of passer. Nobody's ever going to be as good as Magic, I don't think, as a passer, but right. He's close to that level of passer as Bird and Magic, you know, probably a better rebounder. Well, Larry Bird is actually a wonderful rebounder, so I shouldn't say that, but I think it's pretty clear to me that just when you consider the athletic force that he's able to place on the game, that he's a better player than Bird or Magic, and he's going to do it for longer than they did as well.
Yeah, I think that definitely if we're talking post-merger, which I think is, as you said, is a fair way to do it, I think he's the second best player of that era. And what's remarkable to me is I like to think when you're talking about player quality, I focus more on peak than career, because I think that's a more fair way to evaluate it. His peak was incredible. I mean, to me, I would define that as the early part of his run in Miami, when he was not only the dominant offensive player he's been almost his whole career, but was a truly great defensive player in the conversation for best defensive player in the league. And to be able to do that and still be the force that he is on offense, both in terms of creating for himself and for others, that's a combination that we've only ever seen one other time during this era.
Yeah, and we don't want to give short shrift to how good he was in 2009 and 2010 in Cleveland. I mean, those teams won 66 and 61 games those years. And really, a lot of people, oh, he melted down in 2010. He didn't try. It was so weird. Like, yeah, he had that one game in game five at home was a little puzzling. I think he was like 3 out of 14 from the field in that game. But also, that elbow injury was a real thing. And people forget that now, that he basically couldn't shoot a jump shot. It's pretty hard when they're just laying off you and you can't shoot a jump shot at all. Now, he was able to evolve to get more of a post game, but that was also a wonderful defensive Celtics team. And I think if his elbow isn't bothering him like that, and it was a real issue, like at the very end, nobody ever remembers this, but the previous round they played the Bulls, it was a 5-game series. At the very end of the game 5 in Cleveland, it was a close game. I think he ended up getting knocked down as he went in for a layup, and the elbow had been bothering him, and then he tweaked it so badly that he actually shot his free throws left-handed right after that. And really wasn't able to get back to shooting the ball in that playoffs. And, you know, I mean, in that game 6, he had, you know, I think 19 rebounds. You're going to tell me that a perimeter player who has 19 rebounds, like, wasn't trying hard enough? I mean, granted, he didn't shoot the ball well, but, you know, it was a great defensive team, and his elbow was bothering him to the point where he couldn't really make a jump shot. So, you know, maybe things change if he hadn't been injured like that, but I think it kind of put it into stark relief that when he couldn't perform incredibly well, that's when he wanted to go to Miami and get more help. But that said, those two Cleveland teams would have smashed, you would think, this version of the Cavaliers.
Well, are we talking? We're talking about with Kyrie and with Love out, or do you think even with those guys helping?
No, with this version right now that we're seeing.
Interesting. I haven't really thought about it completely, but
well, LeBron was way better.
LeBron was better then. I can certainly see the argument.
Yeah, I mean, they had more role players. They're probably a better. Although their defense has been fantastic now since Kyrie went out. I think that's one thing where, you know, Delly is giving them more, frankly, than Kyrie was able to, going back to probably game 2 of that Bulls series. After that, Delly has just been a better player than Kyrie. I mean, they need him as another guy in the perimeter, but now there are really no weak links defensively. I guess JR would be the one that you would look at, but, you know, even he, you put him on the worst perimeter guy for the other team. And, this is a good Cleveland defense. Yeah,
and it sets the table interestingly if we get the finals that it looks like we're going to get with the Warriors, because the Warriors are a team that, other than maybe Harrison Barnes and Iguodala's out there, you don't want weak defensive links, because it gets really complicated in terms of how you're going to defend them. And I'm not saying, oh, if Kyrie's healthy, you start Dellavedova over him, but I think you give some serious consideration to having Dellavedova play more, just shifting the rotation so that Dellavedova plays more against Curry and just makes his life difficult. And you also have Iman Shumpert for that reason.
Yeah, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but one thing I will say is, who the heck is Kyrie guard in that series? It's him on Steph is probably going to be a disaster, especially in his hobbled state. Maybe he, you know, I assume now that they'll sit him out for game 4. I think that's that would be a big problem for Cleveland, especially in his hobbled state, but even in his normal state, trying to guard Steph with Kyrie, and then you put him on Harrison Barnes. Maybe you hide him on Iguodala when Iguodala's in the game. But, yeah, that may be a problem for Cleveland. But we're getting ahead of ourselves here. I mean, this was a wonderful, wonderful game.
It was.
You know, and we haven't done this in a while. Maybe we can get into our little breakdown. We got the last 2 minutes was really interesting. The Hawks had a 4-point lead, and it ended up blowing it. I was watching a game with a friend, and I was like, all right, how are they going to blow this 4-point lead? And he's like, oh, you should tweet that. I'm like, nah, like, you know, I'm just sort of saying that. I don't really believe it, but I kind of did in the back of my head, just not enough to tweet it. And, you know, how it ended up happening. But, I mean, we can start off here under 2 minutes. LeBron started guarding Jeff Teague. I think this is right before he started cramping up, and the Hawks kept getting the pick and roll switch with Thompson, who largely has been excellent in that role. But Teague was fantastic and at attacking Thompson, and he was able to, what he did was he would back up and then get a real running start against him. And Teague has a ton of quickness. So what he was able to do is get him on his heels. And then when you're backing up, it's really hard to jump. The first guy actually, Magic Johnson once said that. I can't remember what the forum was, but he said, yeah, you know, if you get a guy going backwards, it doesn't really matter how good he can jump because he has to, you know, cover back on you. And so he was able to get some really nice shots in the painted area, crossing Thompson over, and then he was able to get some pull-up threes on him as well. So that Teague was able to score, get a four-point lead for the Hawks. After that, it was the Derrick LeBron post-up. He got right on in, passed it out to a wide-open three for Shumpert, who missed it. But Tristan Thompson, who, of course, was just an absolute monster again in this game, got his hand on the rebound. Mike Scott, who played much of the fourth quarter and overtime and wasn't too effective, ended up just getting, you know, didn't really make much of an effort. He didn't turn around and try and use his butt to clear out Thompson or even prevent him from jumping. He just was sort of faced up with him under the basket and decided not to hold him, and Thompson was able to get his hand on the board, and James got fouled, made one out of two free throws.
Yeah, and something we should mention with Thompson as we're going through this with Teague and everything else is that in this game, he was playing with five fouls. And while we've talked about that before, that certain guys play with fouls differently, I thought Thompson was aware of it, but he didn't always play that super safe, you know, style. I think it was it this drive that I thought he fouled Jeff Teague?
Yeah, it was. And that's really, remember when the NBA was supposedly cracking down on contact on drivers? I don't know if you've noticed this or not, and this is all totally subjective for me. I haven't looked at whether more fouls have been called on this or not, but it definitely, I can't remember the last time that someone got called for, you know, putting their hands on a driver or kind of like, you know, chucking a driver with their hip. The refs seem to be letting that go, and maybe it's better to have less foul calls because offense is still just fine, but that's it seems like it's been a change there from back when it was just automatically a foul to put your hands on someone or impede a driver at all. Dellavedova gets away with probably like six or seven of those a game because he's slower than whoever he's guarding. And Thompson got away with it on this one, too. It would have fouled him out of the game because it clearly was a foul.
Yeah, they're calling it in the air still, which they have to. I mean, you can't do anything other than that. But it does seem like they're doing that. The other thing that they're not calling a lot, and I'm particularly aware of this considering the team that I cover, is the grabs and pulls off the ball. It seems like they're just not calling that very much. And you can make a justification that they shouldn't or anything like that, but it's been a change in the playoffs that those calls just are not happening.
Yeah, you're talking about like shooters trying to come off screen.
Exactly. Conley, yeah, I mean, Conley did a great job, but they were never calling it. You know, so if they're not calling it, keep doing it. I mean,
it's, you know, it's not a foul if the referees don't call it. You know, and
exactly.
People cry about that all the time, but that's basically what it is. And yeah, I mean, I was joking with Warriors World account on Twitter that finally a foul was called on Steph off the ball, but it took a rookie Nick Johnson guarding him for the call to be made.
Yeah.
So that's another one. I mean, one thing they are starting to call more now, at least, is the holding the help defender, you know, which Bogut, of course, is a master at. But a lot of guys do that. They'll kind of lock up.
Did you see the hilarious one with that in game three of the Warriors?
I'm sorry, say that again.
So Livingston pulled a Bogut doing that in game three against the Rockets, and they called it. And I was just laughing. I was laughing really hard because Bogut never gets called for it. Livingston is, you know, like half his weight and gets called for it. I thought it was hilarious. But yeah, it is the right call.
Yeah, so getting back to this game, LeBron did get the offensive rebound after Thompson was able to tip it. Kent Bazemore, who, despite his relatively frail frame, I think he's a bit under 200 pounds at about 6'5", he really had a great effort in this game trying to get in on the boards. You know, he was going for every rebound. It's just, you know, a lot of times he doesn't have the heft. He's only 6'5". So, but really an exemplary effort for him. But he wasn't able to get this one with Thompson there. You know, it's not a fair fight between those two guys. And LeBron actually had 8 offensive rebounds in this game. And I was struck by the nature of his effort in contrast maybe to the last year with Miami, where I think last year he kind of had a conception of, all right, I'm on Miami. These other guys have to be helping me. You know, it's not necessarily my job. I can't envision him ever playing a game where he would have had 8 offensive rebounds with Miami last year. And granted, that was inflated a little bit because he had like that one sequence where he had like 3 tips in a row, all of which he missed in the first quarter. But, you know, I think he has a little bit of a different attitude. coming home to Cleveland, where he kind of now owns this team again, for both on the court and to some extent off the court. And with the guys out that are out, he's just been all over the place. And it was incredible to watch his effort in this game and also in game two as well. I mean, you remember that sequence when in game two, when he just like kept stopping him. And then at the end of the quarter was just like freaking out and like hitting the backboard and stuff. Like, you know, that kind of effort, I don't think we saw as much of from LeBron last year in Miami, even though he was obviously still a great player.
Yeah. And it's pretty remarkable to see also with a guy who, you know, I'm not saying he's bad or anything, that's past his peak, to see him kind of make up some of that margin with effort. You know, I always love seeing that with guys, and you see it around the league, but to see it with a guy of his talent, I don't know why. It's just, I find it encouraging, I guess is the right word for it.
Well, I think the other part of that too is his jumper is just so broke right now.
Yep.
That he just, he's just has to spend more time inside naturally because he's not going to score otherwise. And also there's something about taking a lot of jumpers that just, you know, makes you a little bit softer as a player. It's just, you don't have to fight as hard. Like otherwise, like you just, if you have to fight inside and get a bucket, you know, you're just in that mode of like, all right, I have to physically dominate. I'm going to dominate with this. And that's, I think, what gets you on the offensive glass a little bit more. And, you know, also, you know, on the defensive glass, he was excellent as well.
Yeah, I like that. And also, I think it does go back to the idea that his team needs him to do that. And I think he's very aware of that. And so he's doing it to make his team win.
Yeah, so the next time down after LeBron makes one out of two, Teague gets that switch again. He had Thompson beat. He went for the straight-up one-handed layup without putting his left hand on the ball. But I think it just slipped out of his hand. It just went right over the rim. So that was a good contest by Thompson. Teague was able to get a good shot. I think most people would like that shot, but wasn't able to get it to go down. Then they came back down. LeBron pushed it in transition after the missed layup. I mean, I think one of the big things that I've taken away from these playoffs, not that this hasn't always been the case, but just something I've noticed more, is just missing a layup is really, especially if it's a guard, is really death, because when those guys drive in hard, they always end up, you know, 3-4 feet behind the baseline after their shot because they have so much momentum, and the other team can get out in transition. That's what happened this time. The Hawks were really bad just matching up with their men in transition, and LeBron somehow got on Bazemore. He was able to get right on in on Bazemore just due to Bazemore's lack of strength, and then find Thompson out by the elbow. Thompson was able to score over Bazemore. LeBron, with a nice little veteran trick, gives up the ball and then just kind of continues to plow into Millsap, and basically like pushes him over the baseline. So the only guy there to protect the rim was Bazemore, and Thompson still had a great finish over Bazemore, a guy who has a 6'11 wingspan and can jump. So Thompson had a couple of really nice finishes. That's his touch around the basket is an underrated part of his game.
Yeah, it is. And it's also something I think it gives me insight into how he'll grow as an offensive player, because you think about somebody like him, that he can still expand his game a lot. And I think that if he can get more reliable in that, you know, in that maybe restricted area or restricted area extended, you know, the paint that's not there, he becomes a really valuable player, even if he never gets the real range on his jump shot.
Yeah, back when Cleveland was terrible, they would give him the ball on post-ups and ISOs, and he wasn't really able to hit a jumper, but he could at least get into the lane and hit floaters and hook shots at close range. So, I mean, he does still have that in his game. I don't think they'll ever just throw it to him in an ISO. I don't see that as part of his future with all this offensive talent they have on the team, but he can definitely attack off the dribble for one or two dribbles reasonably well because he has that experience.
Do we want to talk about the lineups that were in play right now? I think that was one of the fascinating parts of this game.
Yeah, I mean, so Schroeder didn't play hardly at all. He played 3:28, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Antic barely played at all. What did he play?
Antic played 13 seconds, the last 13 seconds of the game.
That's right. Yeah, that was a little odd. He was the inbounder on
We'll talk about that.
That last play. We'll get there. But, so he went away from both those guys. I think they just needed more shooting on the floor. And to some extent, it worked. I think, you know, their shooting was better. They were 11 out of 30 on three, so they weren't just like, you know, totally broke the way they were in those first two games. And they also were able to get to the foul line a little bit more as well for, they were, let's see, what were they from the foul line?
The Hawks were 28 to 32.
Oh yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah, no, that's so. Yeah, they, and that's granted. That's in the overtime too. So
yes,
and but yeah, Millsap was 11 out of 11. Teague was 9 out of 9. So yeah, that was. And then they only turned the ball over 7 times as well, which was also, I think, having Schroeder out of the game, definitely, you know, whatever you think he's going to do, the fact that he can't shoot and the fact that he, you know, is a high turnover guy really was hurting their efficiency. We had been calling in previous series for them to go to Mac, and I think that that helped out quite a bit in having a better offensive performance in this game. Well,
especially when you have Dellavedova out there and you don't need the defensive value that Schroeder brings. Granted, Schroeder's not the greatest defender yet, but he brings intensity and all that. And Dellavedova, I mean, he was left open, kind of strangely, a bunch of times, but they didn't really need that. And the, generally speaking, the Cavs weren't playing as strong. They were playing Shumpert, who is good offensively, but not that kind of like Bradley Beal type guy, which is what Schroeder was doing in the Washington series.
Yeah, I don't think he was left open strangely. He's left open because LeBron, like, knocked their entire team backwards under the goal. Like,
that's true.
Yeah, so Cleveland went with the Dellavedova, Shumpert, J.R. Smith, LeBron, and Thompson lineup. They even ran with LeBron at center a little bit in this game. I think with the shooting that was on the floor for the Hawks once Horford went out, and then when they weren't playing Muscala at all either, there was really no one for Mozgov to guard, so he was taken off the floor by that. But yeah, I mean, so we'll get into the end of the regulation here. Millsap was guarded by LeBron. This to me was actually the key play. Hawks are up 3 right now, right? No, I'm sorry. They're up 1. And after the Thompson layup, Millsap was guarded by LeBron. He kind of beat him a little bit, but LeBron got back in front. I mean, it's really amazing. Like, if LeBron is locked in, can be one of the best power forwards in basketball, and you're not posting him up. Like, he seems like he's a small, but he's the size of a power forward, and he has greater quickness, and when he's really locked in, greater intensity than almost any power forward. Like, Millsap just really had no chance one-on-one with him. But even though LeBron was able to get back in front of him, Dellavedova came over and doubled, and then when Millsap dribbled out to the perimeter, Dellavedova just followed him to double-team for no reason. Carroll did a great cut. JR was 2-on-1 against Carroll and Bazemore under the basket. They threw it to Carroll. Carroll had an easy layup, but he had to explode off of his left foot, his left leg, that injured leg, and it kind of didn't quite get enough explosion and was missed the layup. JR had a nice contest on that. So that was one of the key plays of the end of regulation. And then was the famous play where LeBron was in transition. They had a fast break. I think he was just expecting the foul. Teague just didn't really move at all. Got his hand on the ball. There was some contact between LeBron's knee and Teague, but with Teague not really moving at all, I'm not sure why LeBron was so adamant for a foul there. I mean, he did kind of get sent flying, but I mean, I guess that's why you always think that anytime someone gets in front of you, it's a foul. But then he spent probably the next, like, the next 10 seconds just on the floor complaining for a call. Maybe the cramps were bothering him as well, but, you know, he didn't even make an attempt to get up. So Atlanta had a 5-on-4, which actually ended up playing to Cleveland's benefit that LeBron didn't get up, because they had, I think it was when Teague had the ball, it was 24 seconds left in the game and 20 seconds on the shot clock.
It was a 3-second differential.
Yeah, 4-second differential. Teague just goes for no reason, throws it to Mike Scott in the lane, and then Tristan Thompson had an unbelievable block on Mike Scott. Great block with his left hand. If you're a young big guy, learn to block shots with both hands. That's like one of the most important things. Like, no way Tristan Thompson blocks this shot right-handed. It was way out to his left side. Scott adjusted in the air, and Thompson just got it. And then there was a highly questionable loose ball foul called on Carroll going for the rebound with Shumpert.
Yeah, and so, like, for me, I think that this was the key possession, and the reason for it is that, for whatever reason, the Cavs weren't fouling, and also you had LeBron out of the play.
I don't know if I would have fouled there. I mean, 4-second differential, you probably wanted to, and down by one, you probably are okay just taking the timeout with 4 seconds left. But that assumes
that you're gonna, you know, that the shot resolves with 4 seconds left. If you do something high or something slow, and you take it, let's say take 2 or 3 seconds. I mean, and what if it? I'm somebody who, in that circumstance, I foul. I understand that other people don't, because I just feel
I
like it's easier.
Four seconds is just enough. 3 seconds it starts getting a little dicey. Because also remember, like, it's running it down all the way to four is somewhat rare. I mean, now if you're a really smart team, what you want to do is take a three, basically with like one left on the shot clock in that situation, because then the clock will continue to run down
until it's
caught. You just have to make sure that shot hits the rim. If it hits the rim, then you can kind of get the extra second and a half or so that the ball is in the air. I have no idea how long that actually takes, but that's my estimate. And when that happens, then you're right. You're down at, you know, 2 seconds or so, even if you get the rebound and call an immediate timeout. When they had timeouts left too.
Yeah, and then also all you need to do in that case, if you're the offensive team, is just hit the ball. You don't have to go for the rebound at all. Just hit the ball, because if you hit it off the backboard, if you hit it anywhere, the game's over.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little terrified of getting a loose ball foul in that situation.
True.
I mean, that is one of the secret killers in basketball, is getting a loose ball foul going for an offensive rebound when your team is in the penalty. But anyway, yeah, I mean, we may be obscuring the fact that it was just colossally stupid.
Oh, yeah, because yeah, even if we're arguing the minutia, he went with, what, like 11 seconds to go? It was a lot more.
No, it was even more than that.
Oh, no, it was 11 left on the shot clock, maybe. So maybe like,
yeah, I don't know what it was.
It was a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I looked down, I was like, oh, 4 second differential. Like, they're good. They're going to wait now. And then we're still like, oh, where the heck is LeBron? So, I mean, I really just, I don't know what that was. Like psychologically, you have to wonder what's going through his head. Is he just so aggrieved at the call that he just, you know, didn't, or just assumed that they were going to foul or something, so he didn't have to get up? I don't know. I mean, you know, as much as we can praise his performance in this game, like, he definitely does some things like that on occasion that really, despite his reputation as a guy who plays really hard and a guy who's really smart, like, he'll do some things that belie that on occasion.
Can I blame his time in Miami for that?
I can't wait to hear what the rationale is here.
Yeah, so as you talked about, so there's the foul on Carroll, and then so we're getting into the situation, but so the Cavs...
Wait, hold on, no, what does this time in Miami have to do with anything?
Oh, I just thought that those guys complained a lot more about calls than he did before he was in Cleveland.
Oh, okay, yeah, you know, I don't remember how much he did before he left, but yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess Dwayne Wade is another... He is the master of claiming he got fouled as he's not getting back on defense.
Yes, that was the implied part of this. But I was subtweeting Dwayne Wade, but now it's text.
All right. So yeah. I mean, so did you think that was a foul on Carroll?
No.
And I mean, what I thought was so egregious about it, we never really got the greatest of replays there, but to see whether it was a foul, but Cleveland had the rebound anyway. Like, it went straight to Dellavedova. And, yeah, you know, you might make that call if you're a referee. Like, I've refereed just, you know, at very low levels before. And, I mean, sometimes as a referee, like, you have to see something and call it. You can't evaluate for the situation or anything like that. And, you know, maybe that's what happened to Kenny Maurer. I don't think he even had the greatest look at it. He was the outside, I don't know if it's called the outside official. He was the guy on the sideline official, I think is what he would have been called there. But, you know, he was still pretty far away. I thought there was even a guy in between them a little bit. So I don't know if he got the greatest look at it. And then the ball went straight to Dellavedova. Not a call you would have liked to see made. Shumpert made one out of two free throws. And then we went into the last play.
Yeah, and the Hawks called a timeout. You and I are both no timeouts, but I guess in this specific circumstance, maybe you need to say, wait until the last second to shoot.
Yeah, because apparently Jeff Teague doesn't know that, so Coach Bud had to tell him. I would have called that timeout, too, after we already messed up not waiting until the last second. And obviously when it's tied, you need to wait until the end so the other team doesn't get an opportunity.
And LeBron was upright, so you don't have to worry about taking it's not like you were taking advantage of that, so.
Yeah. Yeah, so Shumpert, I mean, I can't remember any clutch free throws that he's ever had. I mean, that's always a tough situation when you're not used to taking clutch free throws. And he made one out of two. The first one was pure. The second one was off. And then they ran into they went for a different approach, attacking the weak link of JR with a 1-3 pick and roll with Carroll and Teague. Cleveland had a very odd way of defending it. LeBron basically... And then got in his head that he wasn't going to switch, and he just basically pushed through Carroll. But Teague was able to get quite an open look, and JR, I'm not sure what his what scheme he was executing, I think it was the right move to go at him, because he was just kind of hanging out down by the top of the circle. You know, he wasn't really guarding Carol for any kind of a pop, and he wasn't really helping out. I'm not sure what the point was there. And even as it got so late that you couldn't even make a pass to Carol, he just stayed there, essentially. And T got a good look, but couldn't knock it down. So I don't know. I don't think LeBron and JR were on the same page there, but it ended up not costing.
I think LeBron just decided he was going to blow up the screen, and JR is kind of standing there going, okay, how does this work? And I would hope for myself that my instinct there would be just do something to help, and I think his instinct was more just kind of stand here and try to figure it out. And yeah. I don't know if that's what happened. That's my theory on it, at least. So then we go to overtime.
Yeah, and I mean, we'll go through this a little bit faster and get down to the end, but yeah, I mean, Carroll tweaked his knee early on in that first drive, and really every time he would try and take off on that left foot, you could tell that he was tweaking it, especially when he would drive in off one foot, and that's a lot of his game is attacking the basket off one foot. So, you know, his knee kind of buckled when he went up for that layup. He got blocked by Smith again. James at this point was cramping up pretty badly. This was the moment when he asked to go out, and then he didn't. He missed a drive, kind of hobbled back, and then Teague just blew by him, and he had to give a foul. And that's when he said he was going to go out of the game, and then decided not to. And you know, he said after the game, "Oh, you know, I couldn't go out, like I had to like help my team." And it was interesting. This again is an interesting. You know, I don't know whether his cramping was as bad as it was in you know, that game one against San Antonio last year. But it does seem to be a little bit different mindset when he's the only guy out there. You know, maybe his thinking was, all right, I got Dwayne Wade, I got Chris Bosh, like, they can handle this, they should handle this. You know, this is why I'm here, versus, all right, everyone is injured, like, I can't be injured.
Yeah, and it was also kind of interesting to me just in terms of the way he talked about everything after the game and basically said, you know, there's no chance I'm going to miss game four. And I was kind of thinking to myself, you know, it might in some ways be if you feel confident that you're going to win the series either way, you know, maybe taking a couple days would be a good thing. But
I feel like you can't mess around with it when you're the road team. If they were up 3-0 and they were the home team in the series, I might agree with you. And also, if they get through this, then, you know, they're going to have plenty of time to rest.
That's true.
For that Golden State. Because, yeah, I mean, we just saw it happen in Houston. Like, it's so much easier to come back from down 3-1 when you have two home games, especially if you can get some momentum in that game five at home. And this Hawks team, I mean, we got to give them a lot of credit for how well they play. I think
Absolutely.
Coach Bud made some nice adjustments going to get more shooting on the floor. I mean, granted, they got killed on the offensive backboards, but really no worse than they had been before. And, you know, maybe if they have Horford back, now that it was Schroeder out of the rotation, like, just killing their bench, and you know, with Mac, at least when they go under the screen, he can take that three. Antic, pretty much out of the rotation as well. Scott, although he didn't really make any threes, I think he has had enough games in his career when he gets really hot that teams at least respect him out there, which I think is important. So, you know, maybe they can kind of get going here a little bit. It was a shame that Horford got thrown out. We'll get to that, obviously. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Got plenty to say on that, as did some of my mentions, but and some of it quite pejorative. But but yeah, I mean, I think they did kind of find something. I wouldn't want to mess around. I think you got to close it out in game four at home by, you know, whatever means necessary, and then you rest.
Yeah. And then one of the dynamics that I noticed a lot in overtime was the effect of fatigue. And so fatigue can go a lot of ways. Sometimes it's that you don't make a closeout that you think you're going to make. And sometimes to me, it's you make an unnecessary gamble. And I think we saw a couple of those kind of early on in the overtime that ended up shaping the rest of it.
Yeah, there were some real mistakes by the Hawks defensively, unforced errors in the overtime that, you know, there was one play in which they threw the ball to James in the corner. Millsap, who did a very nice job guarding James one-on-one overall, just gambled on that pass for no reason. That led to a Thompson and one, another fantastic finish over Scott. But, you know, Millsap just took him out of the play with a gamble. There were two other times they couldn't get matched up in transition. One time Bazemore went for a no-hope offensive rebound, and that resulted in that tough Smith three. Millsap did a great job closing out on him, but, you know, that he wouldn't have had to do that if Bazemore hadn't gone for an offensive rebound for no reason that he had no chance of getting. You know, there was another time when Jeff Teague just picked up LeBron in transition for no reason. You know, Millsap was right there behind him. Teague just decided to guard LeBron instead of Matthew Dellavedova, and they got away scot-free on that one, but just another mental error. So I think, you know, and then Mike Scott was able to get some open threes and just wasn't able to knock them down too. So that's, I think, what they can look back for on in the overtime of places where they could have done better.
Yeah, and then after the kind of, as that was going out, that's when Jeff Teague started trying to take over the game. And he was just going. I mean, he was going, and I don't know if he realized that he always knew, but he had an advantage on Dellavedova, and that's when he, was it two or three possessions in a row where he really pushed it?
Yeah, I mean, he was able to get a foul on Dellavedova. That was the one blocking foul that Dellavedova finally got called for, which was actually probably the least egregious of like five or six more instances during the game. I thought Millsap did a really good job on LeBron. That definitely hurt their rebounding, of course, since Mike Scott is not a great rebounder. He was matched up on Thompson. But at least Millsap was able to avoid getting backed down by LeBron. And and that was, especially once he started cramping, that was really LeBron's like modus operandi at that point. It was really... It really got just into a street fight there at the end as you know, teams would switch. Like, Thompson was on Teague a bunch of times. Teague hit a great pullback three on Thompson after Thompson stopped him the first time. And then the Hawks were up by two. That was their last bucket. They were up 111-109. And at that point, James drive left. He was stopped by Millsap. He missed a floater on the left baseline. And, I mean, I was critical of Scott on some of the previous offensive rebounds. Tough position for him here. He came over for the help. LeBron pulled up. Thompson was able to get right in behind him. Shelvin Mack was on the backside, but he also has to guard the backside corner a little bit with LeBron's passing ability. And there was really no one there to box out Thompson. Scott tried, just wasn't strong enough. Thompson got the rebound. Maybe you could say they wanted to foul Thompson there under the basket, but that's not really something that teams normally do. Millsap tried to get the rebound as well, and then LeBron was open for the three. Millsap wasn't able to quite close out of him, and LeBron hit probably the biggest shot of the game to go from down two to up one with about 36 seconds left.
Yeah, it was an absolutely massive shot, and when you consider the context of LeBron basically asking and then not asking to go out of the game, was pretty incredible, considering he basically hasn't made shots all series, all playoffs from there, and it was remarkable, and I had no issue with Michael Scott on this play. However, we're getting into a play where I had a big issue with Michael Scott.
So the Atlanta did a really nice job. They called timeout now, down one. I like that timeout because you wanted to set it, and they had plenty of timeouts left, to set up the two-for-one, which they did end up getting. Teague just blew by LeBron one-on-one and was right in the lane. There wasn't really any help. You know, there could have been better help, but there wasn't. And you could tell he had a chance to dunk it. And he brought the ball up like he was going to turn it over and dunk it. And he should have gone for the dunk because that's how you get the foul call, at least, if you're team. I mean, LeBron was in chase down mode. Teague, you know, was definitely scared of that. Most players in the league are. They know LeBron is behind them. They know that he's famous for those chase down blocks when he just swallows dudes up. But I think you got to go for the dunk there. Teague instead went for the layup, was distracted by LeBron, and really never even hit the rim on his layup attempt. I think it slipped out of his hand or he just got spooked or whatever, but that was it would have been nice to see him go for the dunk there. You know, easy for me to say that a 6-foot point guard should go for the dunk, but you know he was thinking about it, and I think he was like, all right, I'm not quite sure I can get this, or this might get blocked. I got to go for the layup. But, you know, that's how you get the fouls, by being aggressive and going for the dunk.
Yeah, I think the reason, another way to phrase that is it changes the worst case scenario, because generally speaking, you're forcing the call. There's a possibility to get the block, but I think there are a lot more positive outcomes, just because if you miss it, we've seen it a lot in these playoffs. If it misses and there's contact, then you can get the call a lot easier than on a layup, because on a layup there's just a lot more variance. The ball bounces out, it gets hit by Shumpert and Carroll, goes, to, in my opinion, pretty much right by Mike Scott, and he just lets it go.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how he could have had in his head that it would have been off Shumpert, because Carroll clearly provided the momentum, hitting it in that direction. We got to give Carroll some credit, by the way.
Oh, man.
LeBron, whatever he's dealing with, he's not dealing with potentially, like, free agency sabotaging knee injury here. And Carroll just stuck his nose in there, as he did a million times in these last two games. You know, jumping, when you have a knee injury or an ankle injury, jumping into a crowd like that when you don't know what's going to be underneath you when you land is just so hard to do mentally. And he was able to get a hand on it. Scott was right there and just, I don't know, didn't go for it. Did you see anything after the game? Did anyone ask him about that? I haven't seen anything.
I didn't see anything either. I also didn't have the benefit of many replays because I didn't have the ability to rewind. And I was just sitting there kind of losing my mind because I was just going through that. But yeah, I mean, Carroll, I originally actually kind of, when I was thinking about talking about this game, that was actually where I thought about starting, even over LeBron, just because it's so remarkable what he's been able to do. I mean, granted, his injury isn't as severe as you and I had worried about on that podcast immediately after game one, but it's such a hard thing, and what he's being asked to do. I mean, he wasn't guarding LeBron as much in this game, but, you know, as you said, jumping into traffic, it's a lot to ask of a guy, and he's been fighting every step of the way, and he's been pushing it as much as he can, and there are just some things he can't do.
Yeah, I mean, and frankly, like, with them down 3-0, I might say just don't even play in the next game. Like, you're not going to win the series. You know, you gave a really, really game effort. Like, just don't risk it. You know, I mean, that's not the way that's not his attitude. I highly doubt he's going to do that, but I think that would be my advice to him ultimately, because, I mean, when you have that kind of weakness in your knee, I think it's really easy to exacerbate the injury, and, you know, whether it's causing more cartilage damage or potentially, like, actually injuring a ligament more than it already is. I mean, when you have a sprained knee, that's like what a sprain is a slight tear in your ligament. And, you know, that's when you're going in a free agency, when you got life-changing money at stake, you know, you tried to do it for your team. He deserves all the credit in the world for that, given his personal situation. But, you know, that my advice then would be, all right, just sit out game four, like, it's over. Nobody ever wants to think that way. That's not the way a lot of athletes think, but that's what I would tell them.
Yeah, I completely agree. But we'll move on to the rest of the game. So, as we said, Michael Scott doesn't save the ball. They go to a very long replay review. They rule that it was out off DeMarre Carroll.
Unnecessarily long, by the way. I mean,
oh, yeah, it was a quick...
One angle will show you that, you know?
Yeah, and so then it's Cleveland ball. And do you want to go through it, or do you want me to go through it?
Yeah, well, it was... No, because I love hearing myself talk, so that's why I have this podcast. And also why I'm a lawyer. So anyway, yeah, it was, they finally went to a pick and roll with James, and it was really weird. They had Bazemore on the floor. They didn't have Scott on the floor, which I understand. But Bazemore was guarding Thompson, and Millsap was on LeBron. I thought Millsap did a nice job on LeBron, but, you know, maybe you would have gone with Antic there, but, you know, then you worry about the pick and roll defense. It was just, I would be interested to know what the thinking was having Bazemore on Thompson when you consider the potential for an offensive rebound. But, and then they could have switched the play maybe, but they didn't. Bazemore just hedged out, and while Millsap went under the screen, and LeBron attacked that really well. Millsap wasn't quite able to get back in front of him, still avoided getting knocked backwards too badly. Might have even committed a foul there, and LeBron was able to finish the layup to put him up three.
Yeah, and I think that, yeah, it was an interesting situation with Bazemore. I kind of felt for him in that sense because he just doesn't have. But I thought Millsap played it pretty well, but LeBron was just LeBron.
Yeah, I mean, he just wasn't able to quite get there as he went under the screen, and LeBron did a great job of attacking that hedge by Bazemore, knowing that it was just a hedge, it wasn't a switch. And just powering right through it. Great play by him. So then it was a sideline out of bounds after a timeout for Atlanta. I might have wanted to go with the no timeout here, especially when you had kind of weird matchups in, with Bazemore. And I am of the opinion that when you're down three, it's easier to get a three when you're coming down full court without a timeout, because then the defense is able to say, well, you know, we need to make sure that we're not going to give up a three. Whereas guys wouldn't necessarily know time and score as well right away, and you might be able to get one. But on the first inbounds, Antic had Teague wide open, flaring away to the other side of the arc, missed him completely. And then the second time they tried to inbound, Cleveland did a great job. They got it into Mac. Mac had to just create something against Dellavedova. Did a great job. He got a great look. And then Millsap, with a nice little shove to the back of Thompson, was able to get a long rebound that went right to him. Tough pass to the corner, though, to Mac.
Yeah, and Mac, I think it kind of came in a little bit of a different place than he expected, and then he caught it, I think, to his left, and then ended up moving to his right and shot.
Yeah, it was, it still was wide open, though.
Oh, yeah.
The best look you can hope for, didn't make it, and everyone collapsed, knowing the series was basically over. But yeah, too bad. I mean, it would have been nice to see what this Hawks team could do. I think they found a little more something. Would have been nice if they'd gone away from Schroeder earlier. I think that might have helped them. But yeah, so I mean, now, you know, if Al Horford's still around, they'd probably win this game, huh?
I'm pretty confident they do, especially because you're presumably replacing a lot of Mike Scott's minutes with Horford's minutes, and Horford was playing really well before he got ejected.
Yeah, and while Horford has not been unbelievable on the defensive glass, you think he'd be a little better than Scott, who's really one of the worst rebounding power forwards out there. All right, so let me ask you this. Did you think that Matthew Dellavedova did anything wrong?
Wrong is a very interesting word, and I think that...
He got a technical, the refs.
Yeah, I think that the word I want to use is reckless. And I think that he was pushing really hard. I don't want to, reckless doesn't necessarily imply intent. And I think that's kind of why I like the word. I think he was pushing, and there was a distinct possibility that something bad was going to happen. And he did it anyway. I'm not saying he did it because it was bad, or he did it because he was trying for the rebound, or he got knocked over by Carroll. But he, for the second time in a row and for the third time in pretty recent history, put another player's legs in serious danger. And I understand the desire to respond to that.
Yeah, so Al Horford said after the game, quote, "Was it on purpose or not? We don't know. Maybe it wasn't on purpose, but just his track record, I just felt like it was." And Damari Carroll said he understood Deli playing hard, but, quote, "There's a difference between playing hard and playing crazy." And I think that's about right. Like, I sympathize with the Hawks. I mean, I think, you know, that Korver play, you'll remember that Dellavedova, like, actually got stripped at half court. And Korver went for the ball. He didn't go, you know, he didn't really dive, but he went for it hard. And Deli dove for the ball, but then he really, like, kind of rolled over and rolled up on Korver's leg, which I think that's the part of it that I think people might have taken some exception to. I didn't at the time. But, I mean, you now have three incidents in these playoffs where when Dellavedova gets knocked down, he's been involved in you know, the guy's no angel, we'll put it that way. I mean, and I think what really happens with him is he gets knocked down. You know, he likes to fight hard. He's one of these guys. He gets knocked down, and he gets angry that he got knocked down. Like, that's what happened with Taj Gibson, where he just did that kind of cheap play to grab his leg. That's what happened here, I think, where he kind of gave a little bit of an extra to, like, go make sure that he landed on Horford. I think there was some modicum of intent there. I mean, some people see it, some people don't, but the refs did. You know, it's hard to say whether that technical is them kind of splitting the baby, which they'll do a lot, you know, with the double technicals. But, you know, I think the issue to me with the ejection from Horford, you know, granted, there seems like there's a black letter rule there that, you know, if you go to someone's head with an elbow, you need to get thrown out. But I think there needs to be some leniency on a play when even the refs realize that he did at best a dangerous play and, you know, at worst something intentional. They said that he tried to make contact with Horford's leg with his head and shoulder area. And, you know, that when someone goes after your legs, I think it's understandable that right in the heat of the moment like that, that you're just going to respond in that way. And I think that a flagrant one was merited there, but not a flagrant two. At least you know, not by the black letter rule, which I understand that's what the refs said to the coaches. You know, we didn't have a choice. We had to throw him out. But you know, in terms of fairness and justice, yeah, I don't think he deserved to be thrown out.
Agreed. I said at the time I thought it was a tech and a flagrant one, and I think that. And the challenge in some ways with it also, this doesn't affect the ruling because they have Ann Shoulders in there. I don't think he hit him in the head. I think he wanted to, but I don't think that Horford on Dellavedova. And so there was a point that I really liked that I think Charles Barkley made, which is like, he missed. You don't give him the flagrant two when he missed. And I mean, that's why they put Shoulders in there, but I think that also is.
No, I think that was, they were talking about Deli tried to make contact with Horford's knee.
No,
with
his head. Agreed. No, but what I'm saying is, like, the rule in terms of doing the elbow is that I think it's if you hit the guy in the head or you hit them in the shoulders. I think that's a part of it, too. Because I think
I think it's
neck and shoulder, neck and head?
Yeah, I think it's above the shoulders.
Oh, so then they could have called it that way, too. They could have just said, oh, he missed, and give him a flagrant one.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's obviously not the way the refs saw it. And I think there was some contact there with the elbow. After he swings the first time, then he kind of lands on him and brings the elbow back slightly. But, yeah, you know, Deli just gets upset when he gets knocked down. I mean, you saw it happen in that play later on where he almost grabbed Teague's foot and then, like, stopped it after he got knocked down again. But, you know, LeBron had a good thought on this, which was essentially – his quote was, in game two, when Antic two hands shoves me off the air, the fact that I'm still playing, we don't talk about it. And, you know, he didn't respond there. And Horford did respond. I mean, I think Antic's play with LeBron is pretty close to as dangerous as what Dellavedova was doing. Although, you know, again, there's this reputation issue with Dellavedova. But, I mean, I got a lot of flack on Twitter for saying, you know, that Dellavedova was somewhat culpable, even though this is now the third incident and then the almost grabbing the foot is the fourth. But my thought on this is, look, like, it's nothing against him personally. I am for a game in which guys are not rewarded for making plays that might potentially injure people. And, you know, the Cavs were rewarded because Dellavedova did this. They were rewarded for him making that cheap play to grab Taj Gibson's foot in game five of the Chicago series. You know, and they were rewarded by having Kyle Korver now maybe out 4 to 6 months, according to Damari Carroll. He's now getting a second opinion. So, you know, and the Antic play was just as cheap and just as dirty, and I said so at the time. It's just, I want to see basketball players playing basketball, not trying to injure each other. You know, if you're going to go hard, that's one thing. But if you're going to, like, make contact with people's legs, like, Dellavedova didn't even get called for a foul on that play.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think there's, And I even was corresponding with a few high school coaches on Twitter as well about this. And one of the themes was, look, like, we tell our guys, you got to go hard for the loose ball. And that's fine. You know what? Like, I understand that. Like, you need to instill that in your players that you're going hard at all costs. And I got a lot of tweets telling me I was a wuss, basically. We'll clean that up. But, you know, my feeling is that's fine. Go hard for the ball, but it's still a foul. Like, players still need to be protected by when somebody is out of control and reckless, and that's what Dellavedova was doing, and, you know, that's what some of these other places in the playoffs have been.
I mean, there's a parallel to me. You know, it's like you always want to close out hard, but if you close out hard and you hit the other guy, that's a foul. That doesn't mean you don't close out hard. That just means that sometimes when going hard pushes into a risk for another player or that, then it's a foul. That doesn't, just because something you want to encourage a behavior doesn't mean it's never a problem. I mean, it's, to me, there's a pretty clear line there in some ways. I mean, in other situations. So you still encourage the behavior, but you understand that just because you're doing the right thing doesn't mean that you're clear of all consequences. And in this case, as you said, specifically get rewarded. It's not that they were avoided consequences. I mean, Al Horford got knocked out of the game. I mean, got knocked out of a game, not because of injury, but because of dropping an elbow. And I was very frustrated and I was kind of surprised by the response. I think that the larger arc of all of this is, you and I have talked about it before in terms of charges, is player safety. And, you know, the basketball is lucky that it's not a sport that has the susceptibility of head injuries and things like that some other sports are having to worry about right now. But that doesn't mean that they can be fast and loose and, you know, let these guys play, because there are lots of injuries. We're seeing it sadly enough in these playoffs that can still happen in this sport. And I think that some of those are not preventable. Some of them are. And I think you do what you can within the realm of making it still basketball to make it sustainable and to make it so that the best players stay on the floor, and that people who prevent that, whether it be, you know, through a foul that has no part of the game, or whether it be people who are just reckless, that you discourage that part of it because you don't need it.
Yeah, you know, so I think that's probably enough on that now, yep. Unless you have anything else to add.
Do you want to move on to news then?
Well, yeah, well, we also didn't talk at all, because we didn't record over the weekend, about Game 2, which is really, okay. That's when this series kind of ended. Not only, and I mean, it ended, you know, to borrow from, a Tuesday morning quarterback, I wrote game over in my notebook when it was 75-56. The series was basically over, I thought, and in that Game 2. The Hawks were, like, at one point, were 9 of 41 from 3. I mean, and this is... We talked, and Bud adjusted, but unfortunately, I think a little bit too late. We think of the Hawks as a great shooting team, but, you know, really only with Carroll injured, Millsap couldn't buy a three. Teague and Schroeder were both off, especially Schroeder. So really, where is this great shoot? And Antich couldn't make anything either, neither could Scott. The Hawks weren't a great shooting team at that point, and they just couldn't score well enough against that Cleveland defense, which, especially with Kyrie out, as we said, ends up being really good. So that was the big problem to me, is just that, you know, the Hawks individual players, especially Millsap, were not playing well enough. The fact that he could shoot threes and was shooting them with no hesitation throughout the season is really what opened up just a ton for their offense. And I thought that was even worse than Teague's struggles. And Cleveland was just going way under on every screen. Millsap wasn't able to hit anything. He wasn't able to score against Thompson. Thompson basically just shut him down completely. And so that was their problem. They just weren't able to score well enough against what's become an excellent Cleveland defense in these playoffs, much to the surprise of a lot of commentators, including myself.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And also, Atlanta wasn't helping themselves with help defense. I thought that was an issue. To a degree, it was an issue in Game 3 as well, though I think some of that was more conscious. You know, they were doing some things deliberately. But in Game 2 in particular, the Cavs were just getting a ton of open looks. That's the game when Mike Scott left James Jones open like 3 times, correct?
Yeah. Mike Scott was really bad in that game, too. I mean, they went to him, I guess, to try and get more shooting on the floor. I understand the thinking. It was the worst of both worlds for the Hawks defensively, because they weren't helping enough on those LeBron ISO post-ups to actually stop him, but they also were not actually stopping the shooters either. I mean, they'd sort of go halfway, and they were giving up both types of plays. So at least, you know, we talked about after Game 1 that they might try something where they bring over a big and then just have the small get out. Once LeBron tries to post up, they didn't try anything like that. I mean, I think your second option is maybe you try and just have it force the lob and then double team pretty far from the basket if you can on LeBron, so that, because once he gets to the middle, then he can just find anybody and their brother on the team. Like you can, any pass is available to you once you get in towards the restricted area. Whereas if you're getting double teamed hard, that far from the basket, at least it's pretty predictable. You know, making that pass the opposite corner when you're getting a hard double 18 feet from the basket on the opposite side is really difficult. So you can at least kind of plan where the next pass is going and get your rotation set up that way. But, you know, we didn't see either of that from the Hawks in that game too. And LeBron was just unbelievable. He was efficient, which he wasn't in this last game. And then also their three-point shooters were able to get it going.
Yeah, and also I thought Dellavedova played really – he played better defense in Game 2 than Game 3, and I thought that was a huge swing point in the series, because he did just a really nice job, and that helped keep Atlanta out of their rhythm too.
Yeah, Shumpert was 4 out of 6 on threes in that game too. James Jones, 3 out of 5. I mean, he really has had a fantastic playoffs. You know, I don't know exactly what he's shooting, but it's got to be over 40% from 3. I mean, he definitely – the man can shoot the ball, and nobody's really been able to take advantage of him too badly on the defensive end. I think, you know, the Warriors may be that team ultimately that's going to maybe attack some of these weak links from Cleveland. And, you know, I guess it's really, and again, we'll talk about this more, but I still don't know with this Cleveland team. Like, I keep underestimating them, but it also could just be that they're playing some pretty weak competition.
Yeah, I'm leaning more towards the weak competition part of it right now, but I'm open to being completely wrong because LeBron is... I don't know. I keep on getting the feeling... I don't know if it, in my brain it just goes to history, is I keep thinking that this has moved closer to the 2007 Cavs. You know, that he's moved into LeBron, you know, kind of doing a lot of it. And if you guys remember, the 2007 Cavs ran into a pretty good team in the finals, and it ended relatively quickly.
Yeah, maybe that's right. You know, certainly in the sense that you kept wondering how they were doing it against that Pistons team.
Right.
All right, yeah, let's move on to a little bit of news. Probably the lead item here is Jeff Van Gundy being reported as a potential candidate for the Pelicans. Now, he is very adamant in public that he doesn't comment on these sorts of situations. You know, he's not angling for the job or anything. I think he knows Monty Williams pretty well, having coached him. But, yeah, what do you think of, you know, he hasn't coached since 2007, and, B, his fit with the Pelicans?
I definitely understand why he would be interested in this job. I think anybody would be compelled for Anthony Davis. We've talked about how one of their big flaws is defensively. I've always thought Van Gundy was a good defensive coach. I thought that in terms of effort and in terms of scheming, and I think he would be very excited to have a different defensive piece in Anthony Davis. I think... I'm so fascinated with Anthony Davis offensively, but his defensive potential is also awesome because you can play him at either big position and you can do a lot of different things with him. But I think that I would focus more on getting an offensive head coach unless he's going to get a specialist, because I think that Davis is unique and on that end as well, and I worry a little bit that Van Gundy wouldn't emphasize that as much. But, you know, I'm not going to say he's not my ideal choice, but he's high on the list. I think he'd do a very good job there.
Yeah, and certainly the NBA has changed a ton since he last coached in 2007 for the Rockets. And that they actually had, like, a really rough Game 7 loss at home in the first round with McGrady and Yao. They really had a terrible matchup against that Utah team because Yao had to guard Carlos Boozer. He couldn't guard Okur at the three-point line. But anyway, and those Utah teams actually were very underrated.
Yes.
Ultimately, that 08 team was a great team, a really, really good offensive team. But I digress there. I mean, you wonder how much his philosophies, after having been out of the game for 8 years, will work. I mean, not to say that he can't update them. We really don't know. We don't know how well he's been kind of staying attached with the idea of coaching again. He's always been rumored, but there hasn't really, I don't think, been any serious discussions until now. I actually disagree with you. I think that a defensive guy will be able to make more improvements next year because they already were pretty good at offense, frankly. I think they're getting, given the talent and the injuries they had, about as much as you would have expected out of the team offensively. I think they were ninth in offense. So if Van Gundy can maintain that, and with the defensive talent that they have, get them, you know, into the lower end of the top 10 defensively, you know, I think I would probably prefer more of a defensive guy there just because that's where the low-hanging fruit is that you can easily pick.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a great I think it's going to make them better quickly. I think more about where their peak is going to be, and to me, that when I think about Davis, I think that's, you know, 2 to 3 years down the road. That's more my logic. But I completely agree with you that in the short term, like, if their goal is making the playoffs next year, I think that Van Gundy or Thibodeau would be great picks.
Yeah, I always thought that the Thibodeau rumors there were a little overblown because of some of the internal politics with Dell Demps being somewhat embattled from what the reports indicate. You don't want to get a coach who has clashed with a front office previously. And, you know, you want someone who I think you're going to work with and who is, you know, you're going to be on the same page with. Alvin Gentry certainly is, you know, a very affable guy. I think not going to really rub anyone the wrong way, I would imagine. From everything I know about him. So he's a good candidate in that sense. Maybe Van Gundy is kind of a tough defensive guy, you know, but also he's been out for a while. I don't know how much personnel power he's going to want. I mean, you could you could spin it both ways. You could say, well, you know, he's got this great broadcasting gig, so he's only going to come back if he has personnel power. Or you can say, well, you know, he's been out of it for a while and he just wants to coach again and only focus on that and not have to deal with any other BS. So, you know, we'll see where it goes with Van Gundy. I mean, with both, I mean, he's done a great job in his career coaching in both of his stops. So I think you have to be happy about that. You wonder about how progressive he might be offensively, especially. But, you know, I think either he or Gentry would be great candidates. I don't think Thibodeau is quite as good of a candidate, especially because I don't see New Orleans, and there's been some reporting indicating this, I don't see New Orleans paying, you know, $7-8 million a year for a coach. He's already making $4 million. I think he's going to want a raise from that. You know, that's why the Calipari rumors were also like, you know, we're never going to happen. He's already making $8 million a year at Kentucky or whatever. So,
But yeah, do you want to go the other? The other coaching news is interesting too. The rumor that Scott Skiles there could be a possibility that he could be the next coach of the Orlando Magic. That's fun, not only because he played 5 years for them, and I would say had his best years as a pro with them, but also I really like the fit. I've been somebody who's been critical of. I think Orlando has been thinking they were going to get good sooner than they were. And I think that what Skiles can do is he can instill a defensive foundation with them. I do not think that he's going to be the coach for them 5 years from now. But if he can get them ready in the next 2 to 3 years, kind of be the Mark Jackson for this team, and then they can get, you know, their Steve Kerr, then I think they'll be ready for that. I think that's more the plan that they are than that, oh, they're going to be a playoff team like next year or the year after that. I think they need a lot more pieces than that.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think of it. So let me ask you this. Like, what do you think of when you think of Scott Skiles as a coach?
I think of a hard-driving coach who gets his players to play defense and then burns everybody out and leaves.
Yeah, I mean, this Orlando team, 105.2 defensive rating, that was that ranked in the mid-20s in the league. A team that you would hope has more defensive talent than that, but they don't have a ton of defensive talent at the big positions. You know, they're playing Channing Frye at the four. He's really too slow to be a four at this point in his career. Vucevic is pretty bad defensively. You've got guys like Payton. He's got great hands and a lot of potential, but he's a rookie. Tobias Harris, not a good defensive player. And I think whether they re-sign Harris is going to be herald the direction that this franchise is going to go in. I think with Oladipo, Payton, and Gordon, you have guys who can be, you know, make a fantastic defensive trio on the perimeter, but also really one of, you know, half of those guys can shoot maybe, you know, one half out of those three guys can shoot. That being Oladipo, Gordon and Payton are nearly completely hopeless at this point in their careers. And given their free throw shooting, they may not ever improve to be passable NBA shooters. So, I mean, maybe you think with that with Skiles, you can kind of get a, you know, mid-2000s Bulls type of thing going where you can get way up defensively and into the rankings and, you know, get enough post-up scoring from Vucevic or a little spacing from Fry or whatever. But, yeah, he's not – I would have thought that they maybe needed someone a little bit more of an offensive guy to – because they already have the defensive personnel. But, yeah, I mean, I think Skiles has been successful. This is a Rob Hennigan just got a contract extension, but I also think they need to show improvement. And of the people out there that actually would take the job and, you know, maybe would be in their price range, that might be another issue. When you're not winning, you don't want to break the bank on a coach. Out of those people, you know, maybe Skiles is someone who can have some success there. You know, the other thing that's interesting is Tobias Harris and he hated each other in Milwaukee. So,
right.
We'll see what that means, but they obviously can match any offer with him being a restricted free agent. Just the question is, will they?
Yeah, and we'll talk about Tobias Harris a little bit later, but what's makes his situation particularly fascinating is that the could be a situation where his contract is reasonable enough because of the way that the cap is going to rise that they match on him without the intention of keeping him long-term anyway. And that would also lead to a ridiculous dynamic with Skiles and Harris, with Harris wanting to leave but staying on the team. It could be really fun there.
Well, maybe not to be there, but for us.
No, for us.
Yeah.
Oh no,
yeah,
I don't think about their fun. I think about our fun.
Well, yeah, that'll be interesting to see what happens with Harris. One other piece of news, and you may wonder why we talk about this. Terrence Ross had surgery to remove loose bodies and bone spurs in his ankle. You know, why are we bothering with this? You know, they're out of the playoffs. We're not going to see these guys for 8 months. Well, there's a couple reasons. Number one is maybe that explains partially why he didn't have the season that a lot of people were hoping he would have, why he was basically a total non-factor in that Wizards series. And then also just if a guy is struggling to begin next year, you know, or we don't know what the timetable is for his recovery, but or just can't work on his game all summer because he was recovering. You know, these guys don't just show up next year as, you know, 5% better automatically because they're a young guy. Like, you got to actually work on your game and you got to be feeling right physically. So it's something to consider, you know, either what if he plays better or if he plays worse. You know, you got to remember that they have these surgeries and these kind of things can add up over the course of a career for a young player.
They can, and also, as we've talked about before, you know, it's nice to have that summer to really work on your game. We don't know what his diagnosis is. Do you want to talk about the whole Kobe Kupchak thing?
I mean, much sound and fury signifying nothing, I think, just because it's, you know, it's not that much different from what the public proclamations have been. I think if he plays well, that there might be talk of bringing him in back. You know, it also just depends on what the opportunity cost is for the Lakers with that money in the summer of 2016. But yeah, and you know, whether he can coexist with whoever else they bring in, there's a lot of variables still in play here. I don't think it's time to do the automatic farewell tour, you know, but he hasn't finished the last three seasons, obviously. So I think that's probably weighing on his mind, but you know, maybe he can have some success playing 25, 30 minutes a game this year. We don't know who they're going to get this summer either, but I think, you know, if he's still helping the team, maybe he'll really enjoy playing basketball. He's not a guy who I think has said that he ever wants to coach or anything. So this is his life. A lot of people close to him have said that they have no idea what he's going to do when he doesn't have basketball anymore. So maybe he'll be one of those guys who will play as long as he can, as long as he's still contributing. It'll be interesting to see, though, whether he can make that mental adjustment of not being the star on the team, because to continue to play after this year, that's what he'll have to do.
Yeah, that's definitely a great point. And the other reason I wanted to bring this up is that it ties into another quote from Kupchak, another thing from Kupchak over the weekend, which is on Sunday, he told, I think it was Howard Beck and Bleacher Report Radio, that he thought they didn't have the time to methodically and slowly build through the draft. And I
they also don't have the draft picks to do.
Yeah, they also don't. And but so it was so crazy to me because it's so hard to not do that now. I think that's one of the things that we've learned is obviously the Lakers are specially situated to get elite talent without going through the draft, but those really long prime runs, you generally see that, you know, that the draft and that they're built slowly over time, unless you get lucky like the Celtics did. And I don't know, it worried me. And something I've talked about on my podcast before with people from New York and from LA is this idea of, can you really rebuild in those cities because of how the fans are, how their media contracts are and everything like that. And that could be a change with the new CBA. If those teams can't do that, I don't know, maybe they could still get lucky. They always can. But it was something that I've been ruminating on a little bit the last couple days.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fan base doesn't want to hear that you're going to rebuild slowly through the draft. They want to hear, they want hope. They want to, I mean, this is the Lakers TV station did a little bit with Carlos Boozer when they acquired him that said, like, was him talking about how he could, like, wanted a championship so badly he could taste it. And this is before last year, you know, I mean, it's just that you're selling something here to this fan base that has expectations. I wouldn't necessarily read, you know, verbatim into what he said, because, you know, there's a purpose to what you're saying in a public forum. But yeah, I mean, I think also, you know, they owe a pick to the Sixers that's top three protected next year. You know, they also owe some picks to the Magic. I forget exactly what it is where, I think it's 2017, but you know, it might convert into 2 second rounders at some point. So I forget how that works exactly, but yeah, I mean, you know, they've got last year's number 7 pick. They'll have this year's number 2 pick, likely, unless they trade it. So with that, maybe that's enough then to sign some free agents and you have a decent core. You know, they got Clarkson, too, who impressed as a rookie. So, you know, maybe there is enough of a young core here, but I think with the cap space they're going to have, I think maybe that was just the idea is like, we're not going to not use that cap space and build through the draft. We're going to try and sign the best players we can and get good better. And they don't have much incentive now, especially for next year, to be bad because they owe that pick to the Sixers unless it's in the top three.
Yeah, that's definitely a fair point.
All right. Well, so we didn't get a chance to talk at all about Golden State and Houston, that total evisceration. That game is tonight. We'll probably record again tonight and talk about games 3 and 4, whatever happens there in that series, because we've gone on for quite a bit here, as we are wont to do. So you can, that'll wrap up today's show. You can follow us on Twitter. Danny is Danny LaRue, LeRoux. I'm Nate Duncan, Nate Duncan NBA on Twitter. You can, go and subscribe off of the Real GM page or on iTunes. And we will talk to y'all probably later tonight, after game 4 of Houston Golden State. Till then.